This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two former enemies who co-founded the group Combatants for Peace. It's comprised of former Palestinian militants and former Israeli soldiers who have come together to talk about a nonviolent approach to justice and reconciliation. Zohar Shapira, who is joining us from Tel Aviv, served for 15 years in the Israeli military and was a member of the Army's top commando unit. Bassam Aramin, who is joining us from Ramallah, was a fighter in Fatah, a Palestinian group founded by Yasser Arafat. He served 7 years in an Israeli prison for helping to plan an attack on Israeli soldiers. He says that at the time, he was disappointed that none of the soldiers was hurt. Aramin's 10-year-old daughter was shot and killed a year ago. He says it was by an Israeli soldier's rubber bullet, but the Israeli state prosecutor's office closed the case in July, citing lack of evidence. More on that later. Bassam Aramin, Zohar Shapira, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about what you're doing now with Combatants for Peace, let's talk about how you co-founded the group. And that leads us to an earlier part of the story, before you co-founded the group. I'd like to know what you each did as fighters when you were fighters. And Zohar, let's start with you.
Okay. I went to the army more than 20 years ago, in 1987. I was enlisted to the elite units, one called Sayeret Matkal. I was a fighter and then a commander there for 16 years, I think. 3.5 years as duty and 13 years in a reserve. During those years, I made hundreds of military missions, operations, maybe hundreds of them in the West Bank and in Gaza. I was told that I'm defending my country, my people. I believed it in the beginning. But during the years, when I get older and my eyes were open, I saw that instead of defending my country, I do two things. One, I'm oppressing other people, the Palestinian people. Second, I'm making less security and less defense for the Israeli people inside the Israeli state.
Was there a moment where you realized that, or was that a gradual realization?
I can mention one moment. That was the, I don't know, the stick that broke the back of the camel, we say in Hebrew. I was in a small village around Nablus, Shechem. It was 3 a.m., I think, and before in the night. We came to arrest someone who was suspected as someone who sent suicide bomber attackers. And we entered, I took my, not a platoon, like 50, 60 people behind me. And we went into the village, and then we were in front of the house, and I took my squad, or platoon, to the specific house where the guy was living. I was quite proud of the military way I rolled the group. But then there was shooting around and everything. It was a small war, as can I say. And first of all, we went out of the house, a young woman, I think in her 30s, with two of her daughters. And one was so scared because she saw so many Israeli soldiers and firing from all over Israel, and Palestinians were firing around. And she started running towards me and my people, my soldiers. And there was seconds that I have to decide, is she threatening over my soldiers? Maybe she could explode herself, or what, you never know. And she didn't stop when I was shouting to stop, and I was shooting above her head, I think 6, 7, 8 meters, and she freezed. And there was small second that I don't know if there was eye contact, but it wasn't a soldier and his enemy. It was just two human beings, like in a capsule. And it was like a big hammer falling on my head, and I felt, even though physically she wasn't hurt, I knew that I did a crime and I wounded her spirit, her heart, for until her end of life. And I asked myself, if I'm not stopping now, what would ever stop me of continuing and doing this immoral injustice crimes, justifying that I'm defending my people 50 kilometers away. That was the moment that I could say enabled me to open my eyes clearly.
But, you know, it was your job to stay in the military, so what did you do?
Me and other, you know, this unit I was serving is the most glorious unit in Israel. Ehud Barak and all the prime ministers came from there. And we gathered 13 officers and combatants from this unit, and together we sent a letter to the Israeli prime minister, ex-prime minister Ariel Sharon, that we refused to do occupation missions or to humiliate Palestinians or to defend the settlements, etc. And by that, there was a big noise in Israel, and by that we were accused of betrayers or whatever you can call us. We were thrown out of the unit from the Israeli intelligence forces.
When you say you refused to humiliate Palestinians, did you feel that humiliating Palestinians had become a regular part of your work in the military?
You know, it's like in the apartheid, you don't have to do physically things. You just walk as a white guy in South Africa in the middle of the street, and everyone knows that you own everything and the black guys have to obey. This is the same in the West Bank. The Israelis do everything, can take every part of the land and can destroy every house they want, could seize and people and doesn't let them to eat. You don't have to beat them physically or to shoot above the head of a girl. The fact that you are an occupator, and those people live without any citizenship, without any human, without basic human rights, especially in democracies. This is the first step of humiliating.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Zohar Shapira and Bassam Aramin. We've just been listening to Zohar Shapira. He's a former fighter in Israel's top commando unit. He served more than 15 years. Then he co-founded Combatants for Peace, a group of Israelis and Palestinians working together for peace. Both the Israelis and the Palestinians in this group are former fighters. Now also with us is Bassam Aramin. He is a former fighter in Fatah. He spent 7 years in an Israeli prison. His 10-year-old daughter was killed about a year ago. He says it was by an Israeli army bullet. So, Bassam Aramin, I'm interested in your story. You had been in Fatah as a fighter. Why did you become a militant?
Actually, I started struggling against the occupation when I was 13 years by raising the Palestinian flag. It's something to fight or to prevent this or those strange people to come to your village. We don't understand their language. We don't understand why they are occupied us. Then we start, when we grow up, to start to throw stones, to rot in the walls. Then with the 4 or 5 young children, it was 15 years when we found some old weapons in a cave. It belonged to 1968. And we start maybe with the group, they throw 2 grenades on the Israeli patrols. And I found myself, all of us, in the Israeli jail for a long time. I was for, as you mentioned, for 7 years.
So was there a turning point for you when you decided you no longer wanted to be a fighter? Were you still in prison when you changed your mind about that?
Actually, no. In prison, you became more determined to fight. And you don't see any possibility to make dialogue with the other side. But after I release, I changed my mind.
What changed your mind?
All the time I hear from the politician and the militant that this conflict cannot be solved in a military solution. But when you think about this by yourself, you will reach to that. It's the fact. More than 60 years, we are fighting one each other. And what's the result? More killing, more blood, more civilian suffering, more detainees, more than 750,000 Palestinian people enter to the Israeli jails. Israel is not safe, Palestine is not free. There is no end to this bloody conflict, and the civilians is paying the price.
There must have been pressure on each of you to keep fighting and not drop out of the fighting that you were doing. Zohar, let me ask you, was there a lot of pressure from your friends in the military to change your mind, to stop speaking out, and to support official Israel military policy?
Yes, my unit was like a family. I had weeks of a lot of pressure and threats.
What kind of threats? Friends.
Words, nothing, telephones, letters, not nobody hitted me or beated me or something like this, but threats that you know how to treat betrayers and so on. Mm-hmm. I want to say that in those days I didn't understand the fact that there is a non-violent struggle. I just knew that I'm not going to do those kind of missions, that it's not moral. I didn't think that they are could be partners in the for this kind of non-violent struggle in the Palestinian side.
So let's talk about how you both got together and co-founded Combatants for Peace. Who approached who?
Actually, we have a friend, he's ex-fighter, he was ex-prisoner in Bethlehem named Suleiman Hamri. He was work with some Israeli friends from Ta'ish movement, and he know some Israeli ex-fighters. And actually, they told him that if they can make a meeting with the ex-Palestinian fighters also. And by this way, we have this meeting in Bethlehem in 2005.
And, Bassam, why did you want to join the group?
Why? Mm-hmm. Actually, before I joined the group, I heard about the Israeli ex-soldiers who refused to serve in the occupied territories. And I said to myself, I wish that I can talk with them. I want to know their background, why they are refused to come to the Palestinian territories to serve there. Then when my friend asked me if I accept to join this meeting between ex-Israeli soldiers who refuse to serve the occupation, directly I said yes. And I found myself in this group because I discovered that they are just like me. They want the same peace. They are fighting for a simple peace. We used to kill one each other for the same thing. We found that there, we have many things common more than difference as a human being. Yeah, maybe from the second meeting, we discovered that we are going to work a long time together because we are the same. In the first meeting, if I can speak about this, it was a very difficult meeting in my life. You are the first time going to meet your real enemy. He's torture you, he's arrest you, he kill you, he damage your home, he's occupied you. And you must shake hand with him and start talking with him. But after I hear them, I said that we must be a real partner for peace. Already you will have if you look for. And it's not our goal to be friends, our personal friends. But after this, after many months working together as real partners, we became more than friends. And we became a family, actually, believe in the same thing, know our enemy. We are working to end it.
So what did you talk about when you started meeting?
Actually, the Israeli start everyone to said his name and from any unit from the army and something personal story, we call it, where he served in the West Bank in Gaza. And it was very difficult for me to hear that. And I think that some of them, maybe they are crazy, or maybe they are very straight and very strong and very honest people. Because to came to the Palestinians and told them that I was an officer for the worst checkpoint in Palestine for 2 years, and he's a very nice guy, now we are very friends, I cannot accept that. And I just look at him and thought, he's a crazy, or maybe he's a criminal. And I told him that, you know that you are just a criminal. He said, yes, I know. I said to him that, you know that everything you do against the Palestinians is a terrorism. He said, absolutely, I agree with you. And I am here because of that. Because I realized that I just create like more enemies. And actually, I consider him, he encouraged me to continue working with those strong and moral and courage people.
Zohar, what did you find most valuable about the first discussions that you had with the Palestinian fighters who co-founded Combatants for Peace with you?
I think when it became personal stories, I heard where they come from, what did they have they done, how did they fight against the occupation. I learned that through personal contact, through and knowing the guy, the man in front of you, not the cliche or not the stereotype of Palestinian or terrorist, just knowing the man in front of you is the strongest way to fight against fear, based against stupidity. And step by step, the ice was broken and we could start speaking ideology and seeing that even our political goals are very, very similar, and the means that we will use to reach them are very, very the same.
I'm wondering how difficult it is for you both to even meet, to even get together, for the group to meet. Bassam, I know we were trying to arrange for you to speak to us from a studio in Tel Aviv, and at the last minute you found you weren't able to get into Tel Aviv, although you've been able to get in the past. So you're speaking to us now from a studio in Ramallah. How difficult is it for you guys to actually meet together?
Actually, we are meeting in sea areas. It means that Israelis can come there. It's not easy, but they can reach to those areas. And also the Palestinians, maybe in part of Beit Lahem and in Aram, and sometimes in my town where I live, in Anata. But it's not easy. But for peace, for our people, for our children, we choose the difficult way. It's very easy even to fight or to revenge, but it's difficult to go with in our way.
I must say that since the construction of the separation wall, segregation wall, it becomes difficult, more difficult and more difficult to meet, because every week another wall is closed, and suddenly a way that you were driving to meet to the meeting is now closed by this 8-meter concrete wall. So you go backwards and you look somewhere else, and then the soldiers in the checkpoint doesn't let you go from this place, and you have to make a turn around for 30 kilometers, and you never know where could you enter this prison. It's like a prison, you know. Every town, a Palestinian town, is like a prison. And this is, I think, part of the policy of preventing and not letting people to meet. They would do everything so people won't be able to meet, because it is dangerous for them, for the Israeli government. Because when people meet, you can't tell them afterwards that they are enemies, they want to kill you, they want to throw you again to the Mediterranean Sea.
Bassam, you live very close to the separation wall, the concrete wall that Israelis are erecting. And I'm wondering how it's changed your life and your ability to travel anyplace.
As Zohar said, it's a big jail with one or two gates. They can open it and they can close it. And they are trying to kill every Palestinian dream to have state or their own state. It's a big problem. Imagine that in one day, you are cannot go to anywhere. You just look at the sky. For what?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two of the founding members of the group Combatants for Peace. It's comprised of former Palestinian militants and former Israeli soldiers who have come together to talk about a nonviolent approach to justice and reconciliation. Bassam Aramin is a former Palestinian militant who spent 7 years in an Israeli prison. Zohar Shapira is a former Israeli commando officer. Aramin's commitment to peace was challenged when his 10-year-old daughter, Abir, was killed just over a year ago. She was on her way home from school with her sister when they got caught between Palestinian students throwing rocks and Israeli soldiers firing rubber bullets in the refugee camp of Anara on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Abir died 2 days later in a hospital. An Israeli police autopsy found that a blunt instrument, perhaps a stray rock thrown by Palestinian demonstrators, killed her. But Aramin's family hired an Israeli pathologist to re-examine the case. The pathologist concluded that Abir was likely hit by a rubber bullet. The Israeli State Prosecutor's Office closed the case in July, citing lack of evidence against the Israeli military. Last month, the office rejected an appeal, saying there was not enough evidence to reopen the case and that, quote, the head wounds sustained by the deceased were not caused by a bullet, unquote. I asked Bassam Aramin about the death of his daughter.
The 16th of January 2007, this black day in my life, and maybe the first friend who came to me to the hospital was Zohar Shapira. He spent with me with the others 3 days in the Hadassah Hospital in Israel. And in this moment, I said that I feel that this daughter is their daughter. I'm just a part like them. This challenge to continue or not to continue, it was a difficult, very difficult moment. But to revenge, it's not the solution. It's not a personal problem to Bassam Aramin. More than 971 Palestinian kids have been killed since 2000. And no guilty, no suspect, no trials. Abir Aramin is not different. She's like them. But what's different here is Abir Aramin is my daughter. She belonged to me and belonged to my friends. Palestinian and Israel, from Combatants for Peace. They make everything possible to open investigation and to bring the media to focus on this issue that Abir wasn't a fighter. She was a child. And some of them know Abir. We just ask for justice to bring this hero, this soldier, this, to the justice. Maybe he's guilty, maybe he's not. But they killed Abir another time when they deny that they are killed her. In this, I decide that I am going to double my efforts with my friends to protect my other 5 children and to protect Shira. She's like my daughter. She's my brother's daughter, Zohar. To protect those innocent people who are paying the price of this dirty conflict. We don't ask them to make peace. We want them to enjoy peace.
Zohar, I'm interested in your perspective on this and what you've been trying to do for Bassam as his friend and as his co-founder in Combatants for Peace.
It's always so difficult to me to go to those days a bit more than a year ago. As Bassam said, it was like killing my daughter. And I remember those horrible days near the bed of Abir, praying that she would stay alive. I also remember that emotions of revenge came out of me, and I really wanted to go to those military camp and to make revenge with those soldiers who just barbarically shoot over children, actually, as I did more or less a couple of years ago. Ironically, the guy who could cool me and bring me back to the higher emotions, to the understanding that revenge will just open a circle of revenges, was Bassam. I don't know from where he had the courage and the wisdom. Then after seeing this brotherhood that came from this tragedy, these moments I could connect Abir's case to this reality, that hundreds, I think 900 or more or less, Palestinian children were killed. And I know how the Israeli military system goes, everything to do that nobody would become accused or become guilty. And then I saw this system of just, that I believe that Israeli is a democracy, that there is just, that we have judges, we have a tribunal. Then I saw it's the fake, because when the victim is Israeli, we very fast we find the guys who are suspected and we take them to trial and we believe all this, the eyewitnesses. But when the victim is Palestinian, we don't believe Palestinian eyewitnesses. And it's a black day also. It's not just, it's above the killing, the horrible killing of Abir. For me, it's the killing of the Israeli justice system. I can say I believe that there is no just here. There is just for the superior, for the Jewish people.
Zohar, from your perspective, how did Abir's death affect the group Combatants for Peace?
First of all, if before the group was just the guys, the soldiers, I think from that moment we became a family with my wife, my children, all Bassam's children and all the friends. You know, it was more just than guys, men speaking. It was families. And this is the human story. I think I understood that this is the right time to take an action, that if we don't, sorry to say, use this case to break the silence in the Israeli society, more and more children would be killed and more revenge would be from the Palestinian society over the Israeli society and etc. And this is was the moment that maybe I understood that it is not just speaking and talking. This is life. And if we want to make an action, more and more lives will disappear. More and more death would be here.
How much faith do either of you have in the politicians to negotiate a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians?
Actually, we don't believe in politician. To be politician, unfortunately, it means to be liar. For that, we announce that we are totally not politician. We have a political message. We must encourage those politicians to make this negotiation or to put pressure on them that we refuse to be enemy. We want to live together in peace and stability, both Israelis and Palestinians. And this give them the courage that they have the majority in both sides, or to make a pressure on them and not to accept their judgment about the Palestinian or the Israelis. All the time we hear that the Israelis don't understand just the language of power, and the Palestinians don't understand just the language of power. And it's failed. More than 60 years this language, we used it, it's failed. There's nothing happening, just more death and more victim and more killing. It's our life, our children's life is more important than the land, than the border, than everything.
Israel has some peace agreements with Egypt, Jordan, so-called with the Palestinian authority in 93. But those pieces, this piece didn't last because it was a piece of politicians, of papers and the pencils and the signatures. It wasn't peace between human beings, between people. So the only peace that we can reach is the peace between people.
Well, Bassam, let me ask you. You both agree that a lasting peace has to be a peace agreed on by people, not just politicians, and that the politicians might be the last to actually come to a meaningful agreement. But, Bassam, do you really believe that you could convince Hamas and Fatah not to fight anymore and to live with Israelis?
Before to end the occupation, it's very difficult. I don't ask anyone to agree with me or to give me the right to fight against the occupation. We said that, in spite it's our right to defend ourselves by power, but our opinion, it's not work. It make us suffer more and more, the Palestinians and also the Israelis. Through this idea, we are speaking with all of the Palestinians and with all of the Israelis. But I believe that if the Palestinians see hope that there is a process will lead them to establish their own state, to end the occupation, I believe that we, all of us, will be winner and all of us will live in peace. And I don't believe that there is any human being in Israel or Palestine, in Hamas or Shas, want to kill all the humanity, want to kill all the Jewish, or want to kill all the Palestinians. No, we want to live in peace, but without occupation. But with the occupation, with this suffering, with this torture, with this slavery, I don't believe that the Palestinian people will stop fighting against the occupation. But now, at least, we are focusing on don't fight the civilians. To kill civilians, it's not legal, it's not moral. And we, the Palestinians, we are suffering from killing our civilians. We cannot agree or encourage any Palestinians to kill an Israeli civilians, like the same child for 2 days who hit in his shoulder in Sderot from a Palestinian rocket. We are against these rockets because it targets civilians also, like our civilians.
Bassam is always the optimistic one between us. I know deeply the Israeli society and also a bit the Palestinian society. And I see how more and more how the extremists are stronger and louder and in bigger quantities. And there is more and more hate from everywhere, from the schools, from the media, from the street. I wish we'd be still alive when there would be peace, when there would be no occupation. If I would work in Combatants for Peace to reach this goal, and I would be broken. I'm just working because this is the only choice for me and to work towards peace. But I am really doubtful if in my years it would happen.
But you feel it's the only thing you can do right now?
Immorality, after seeing people die before stupidity, Israelis and Palestinians, and just because I see this blood in the streets and in the eyes of Israelis and Palestinians, I must work. But to say that I'm looking for results, I would be naive.
Well, I want to thank you both very much, and I wish you both good luck. And Bassam, I want to say again how sorry I am about your daughter.
Thank you, Telly.
Thank you both. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bassam Aramin and Zohar Shapira are co-founders of Combatants for Peace. It's comprised of former Palestinian fighters and former Israeli soldiers committed to finding a nonviolent approach to justice and reconciliation. A very closed country opened slightly and briefly last month when the New York Philharmonic played at the invitation of North Korea's leaders. Conductor Lauren Mazel hopes the concert helped pave the way to diplomacy. Mazel has been the music director of the New York Philharmonic since 2002. From 1972 to 82, he conducted the Cleveland Orchestra. He was a child prodigy and began studying conducting at the age of 7. One of the pieces he conducted in North Korea was George Gershwin's An American in Paris. Here's an excerpt. Lauren Mazel conducting the New York Philharmonic in North Korea. After finishing their Asian tour, Mazel returned briefly to the U.S. Last Thursday, we caught up with him in Milan, where he was preparing for another concert. Quite a schedule for a 78-year-old conductor. I spoke with Mazel about his experiences in North Korea. Maestro Mazel, welcome to Fresh Air. You opened the concert with both the American and the North Korean national anthems. What do you think of the American national anthem as a piece of music? Do you take any pleasure musically out of playing it?
You know, I as an American, I've got a visual response to the tune. You know, I've been singing it in school, you know, ever since I can remember. And
it's very hard to sing.
It's hard to sing, and the words are difficult, but of course one masters them. And it's, as I say, it's a visceral thing. You hear it, you get goosebumps, and that's, you know, your national anthem. But what stupefied me is that I knew perfectly well that this had been the first time ever in North Korean history since the end of the Korean War that the American anthem had been heard in Korea. And after we played the two anthems, okay, first the North Korean anthem and then the Star Spangled Banner, people actually applauded, North Koreans applauded, and including government officials, and then sat down applauding the American anthem. And that, of course, gave it away. Apparently this event had long been talked about, was long awaited. And the time had come, obviously, to forget the hate and try to move on. Rightfully so, because what is the alternative?
When you were in North Korea, did you have a minder who helped you get around and negotiate your way and who also prevented you from seeing certain things?
They're called guides, not minders. And, of course, we had a guide who stayed in the little guest house my son and I were lodged in. And I have to laugh because I have been minded in so many communist countries in the past. I was in the Soviet Union twice, and the first time I conducted 5 different orchestras, and I had an interpreter minder with me day and night, from whom I would escape once in a while, much to the consternation of this person. But I learned early on that these people are engaged to do that. And if they lose you, they may not only lose their job, but they may also lose their lives. I mean, I remember one translator in Russia bursting into tears. She was a young woman. She said, "You just can't run away from me this way. You have no idea what they would do to me." And so you can't put your minder's life at risk, can you? That's the world they live in, and if you go there, you have to accept the norms. We did have a camera with us, and we asked whether we could take pictures any place, and they said no problem, and which we did. We got out of the car, we took pictures. Not much to take pictures of, because there are no apartment houses, there are no stores, there are no cars, and no skyscrapers. There's no traffic. There's nothing. So what are you taking pictures of? But that in itself is a documentation, though there's nothing there that we were seeing that we didn't know we would see, especially those of us who are old enough to remember the bad old times in other communist countries.
There are so many instruments that if you play them for a long period of time, unless your posture is just absolutely perfect, it's going to create like tendonitis or, you know, other kinds of like physical problems that will give you aches and pains and maybe even result in not being able to play the instrument after a certain age. Anything similar that you face as a conductor? I mean, you've been doing it a long time. You started when you were 7. So, like, what are some of the hazards of conducting?
Hazards. Well, the conductors get conductor's elbow. So many of my colleagues have been operated on. There are cramps, which result from bad positioning. I've always been aware of that, I suppose, because I'm a good violinist trained in the Russian school, where there are all kinds of anti-tension exercises that you have to engage in if you going to play that instrument for hours on end without encountering difficulties, so that I'm able, even at my fairly advanced age, to conduct 6-7 hours without any cramps, without any tension, because I've given a great deal of thought. And if I'm known for my so-called conducting technique, it's because I've given the attention that is required so that it is smooth and functional, and that there's no tension involved other than the intensity of one's musical imperative, which finds its expression in that one sweep or click of the baton where you put all your energy for that split second into a motion which will be efficacious and will have the desired effect. So, yes, my advice to young people is to be sure that the schooling is right. Whatever you're playing, especially the wind instruments, that your embouchure is set just right, and that if you're a string player, that your hands are positioned in a way that will not do damage to your spinal column.
Can you share one good anti-tension exercise with us?
Well, the first thing to do is learn how to breathe. Very deep breath, slow. And then you stand in one position, if you're going to conduct or sing or whatever, for about a minute, and you deliberately relax every muscle in your body. You become aware of the fact that quite a few muscles are tense, and so you relax them. All the way down, through the calves of your legs. And then you take one more very slow breath. And then you say to yourself, what I do here is of no importance whatsoever. I am here as a servant. And if I'm nervous, it means that I think what I'm doing is important. And that is an egocentricity which no interpreter can allow himself the luxury of. You're there to serve the music, and you have to be in the best position, psychological and physiological, to do so, which means no tension, no nerves. Yes, exhilaration. Yes, enthusiasm. Yes, focused energy, but no nervousness, because that's counterproductive.
And do you go through these exercises backstage before walking onto the stage, or are you thinking this for the first few seconds before you lift your arms to begin conducting?
Well, I go through none of this anymore. It's so part of I just take that breath as a matter of course. And my body...
Your muscles are already relaxed?
They're already relaxed because I've been giving it
good for you.
so much thought for so long. It's so important.
Uh-huh. And even in North Korea, you didn't have to tell your body to relax. You were in the zone.
No, I was very, very focused, concentrated, but not nervous.
Mm-hmm. All right. Maestro, thank you so much for talking with us.
Congratulations on
your tour.
Thank you.
Good luck with your performance tonight.
Thank you.
Lauren Mazel is the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. Last month, he conducted the orchestra in North Korea. The New York Philharmonic North Korea concert premiered in February on PBS's Great Performances. To stream the full concert online, you can visit www.pbs.org/GPERF. We'll close with an excerpt of the concert, a Korean folk song.